sheet in your packets that it's got a little information on it. I'll just kind of briefly run down it, and then you can take a look at it. Senator Larson, we all know, is gone. Senator Scoy has replaced him as the vice chair of the committee. We have two new tax committee members this year, Senator Scheid and Senator Rest. They have replaced Senator Larson and Senator Sieben, who, for some scheduling purposes, had to get off taxes. Senator Dibble is going to replace Senator Larson on the property tax division. And Michelle Allen, our Senate counsel to the tax committee, is out on maternity leave. And filling in for her this session and maybe long into the future is Mark Hasty. So get to know him. Our committee page, Charlie Bruce. Charlie? And members, we're going to try and avoid Monday and Friday meetings until we get a little bit more work to do. There's been very few bills introduced so far. So just for your own scheduling purposes, I think we've only got six or eight bills been introduced and referred to the committee. So we're going to hear a few of them next week on Thursday. I believe there's predominantly some TIF bills, I believe. But just for your own scheduling purposes, we're going to try avoid, you can let your offices know, we'll try avoid Mondays and Fridays here at the beginning of the session. Senator Rest is here. Senator Rest, welcome.
Thank you very much, sir.
We should probably get going because I believe Mr. Kurdowski has another appointment scheduled. So, members, today we are going to have an overview of the State Budget Trends Study Commission. It's in your packet. Mr. Goodnow and Mr. Kurdowski have gave this presentation multiple times probably to the legislature already, but this is our first opportunity to hear it in front of the Tax Committee here in the Senate. So welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Kevin Goodnow. I'm a co-chair of the Budget Trends Study Commission.
And I'm Jay Kudrowski, the other co-chair.
And we're honored to be able to appear before you today and give you a brief overview of the commission report. I think it was last week, the commission report was released. And basically, it was set up about two years ago. We had 15 members on the commission, five from the Senate, five from the House, and five from the governor's office. Among that group of 15, we were elected to lead that organization, that group. Since that time, since it was set up, we had 14 meetings. We had numerous hearings over those 14 meetings to gather information preliminarily, hearing overviews from various experts in various agencies, be it from the revenue, human services, education, the demographers area. And then we also did a lot and had staff review the reports that were done previously, other recommendations that had come out before. We did not want to reinvent the wheel. We wanted to take the best ideas and the brightest ideas that had occurred before. So we did an analysis of the previous reports as well. What we came up with in the end, and I do need to make an acknowledgement that we lost one of our members during that time period. John Randall, former senator, was an original member of the commission. Had a lot of great input early on, but passed away during while we were working with the commission. So we want to acknowledge his work and the work of the commission members as a whole. The commission members was kind of a diverse group. We had four different former finance commissioners from four different governor's administrations, independent, Democrat, and Republicans. We had a number of economists, and then we had some riffraff like me sitting around there too. And we were able to come to an agreement on the report. There was only one element within the report that there was some disagreement on, and that was with regard to the inflationary factor. But everything else, we had a consensus among the group to move forward with. And if you keep in mind the membership and the fact we had various economists and former finance commissioners together, it's rather remarkable that we actually did come up with a consensus like that. In the end, we want to acknowledge the good work of the Department of Management, Minnesota Management and Budget Office. Without their work and without their help, we would have never been able to move this forward. And they've spent a lot of time and a lot of effort helping us move forward with this report. In the end, what we did was we came up with 14 different findings, and we'll walk through those. And then we also, based on those findings, came up with three different groups of recommendations that we'd recommend going forward. And I do need to start off, and early on people looked at this commission, you know, I don't know if there's a lot of interest in this commission initially by a lot of people in the outside world. With the current budget situation, I think that interest has elevated a bit. And a lot of people, and some people had the misunderstanding that we would have a silver bullet for them. We're waiting for the commission report to come out so we know how to fix our budget going into this cycle. And what I have to say is we have no silver bullet. What we did was we studied the trends, we studied the demographics that we'll be facing in the future, and based on those trends, those demographics, our budget situation, we came up with their findings and came up with the recommendations of how to better manage the system and identify the problems that we're going to be facing in the future. So this is less of an issue about what we're dealing with today in your budget situation, but talking about the framework and the structure and the tools that we think are necessary as we move forward to try to deal with a situation like this in the future and try to, you know, try not to do it again, you know, that we're in this situation, but if we are in a situation like this, to better manage our way through it. So at this point, I think we'll just move right on to the 14 findings. We'll be going through the report as a reference. I think, does everybody have a copy of?
Yes.
Okay. So if you, the commission findings start on page 5 of the report. And the first finding was that Minnesota is currently experiencing a major long-range demographic shift.
If you look at the two charts, one on the middle of page 5 and one on the top of page 6, I think you'll see something that we're all fairly aware of, but we didn't really think much about the budget implications until the commission met, and that's that we're aging. The baby boomers are 62 years old, 63 years old, and they're within 2 years of the normal retirement, within 2 years of normal Social Security payments. And as the population ages, their demand for public service increases and their ability to contribute tax revenue to the system diminishes. So that's an important trend. At the top of page 6, you can see the various segments that are growing. You'll note that we also have 0 to 4 and 5 to 9 growing fairly rapidly, as well as those seniors, and you'll see the implication of that in a moment. So we're bifurcated, and the elderly are growing, and the young people in the cohorts are growing, and the people in the middle, we have less growth.
The finding number 2 is that Minnesota has become more diverse in recent years, and this will continue to increase as economic growth depends on attracting new workers to the state.
So if you look at the top of page 7, you'll see that our demographics, our diversity is changing fairly, has changed fairly dramatically from 1990 to 2006. It's a trend that is not dissimilar from other states. The nation is getting clearly more diverse. And we expect this trend, the demographer expects this trend to continue as we go forward, that we'll have a more diverse population. The diverse population we have today in the state is actually their reproduction rate is faster than the majority people today in the population.
And if you take that chart into consideration, that trend, and overlay that with the trend on page 6, where we're talking about the growth among children, the children that will be coming into the system in our K-12 education system will be more diverse as well. So along with that will be other challenges that come along with managing that that aspect of it. Finding number 3 on page 7, public spending priorities will need to shift as Minnesota's economically dependent population grows larger and relies more heavily on fewer workers.
If you look at the chart on the top of page 8, you'll see that in the period 2000 to 2010, we're actually at the low point of the number of aged and youth in our population. That is, we have today a maximum of workers, but you can see that that trend's going to reverse by 2030. Over 60% of the population will be in that, the youth and the aged. So it's changed fairly dramatically. If you look on the top of page 9, you'll see that the people graduating from high school is diminishing. And that's something that we hope doesn't continue to occur going forward, but the trend would suggest that it will. you have on page 9 in the middle showing the number of school age and seniors versus the 18 to 24-year-olds. And then on page 10, you see the per capita health care spending, and this is where that aging population becomes a problem because health care spending goes up dramatically as our population ages. So
the key thing, you know, as we talk about the aging trend and that part of the demographic, people, you know, we'll talk about, well, gee, that's going to put an impact on long-term care and nursing home care, but it will actually put an impact on this on the system before that because of the revenue decrease, that because those are the folks that have been working before but now are maybe retired or semi-retired, there's not as much income coming in, but also the burden and the challenges that they place on their families. Whereas before, the dependents, if you had dependents, typically they were children. Now your dependents will be children and your parents. And so that's an issue of being able to manage that as we go forward. And as you're probably aware, as policymakers, anytime there's pressure on families, they usually talk to you about taking some of that pressure off. So something you might want to keep in mind in the future.
And a key fact that I was looking for it specifically, I can't find it at the moment, but a key fact is that by 2030, we will have more people not working than working. We'll have more people not working than working. So the burden on those that are working will be substantially greater than the burden is today on workers in Minnesota.
But on that point, it seems like this next generation of seniors has had at their disposal more retirement savings options than maybe the generation before. You know, the 401ks, probably less defined benefit pension plans, but other vehicles, we have Roth IRAs. Is this generation of retirees going to have more disposable income than the previous one? Did you discuss that at all?
Because
there's been more opportunities for vehicles for people to save for retirement.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, a year ago I would have said yes. But consider what's happened in the marketplace. People that did have 401ks and clearly had stock in those 401ks today probably have their portfolio reduced by 30-40%. It is true that this generation is going to have more wealth entering those years, but the health care costs will be there for them, and there will be dissipating their assets as they age, and we also know that the elderly are living longer. So it's also a change from today that the seniors will be living longer. So it remains to be seen exactly how much wealth that they'll have. But what we do know is that they'll have less income than they had when they were working, which we tax highly, and they won't be spending as much. Most seniors, frankly, don't spend as much, and so the sales tax will be less effective at taxing them.
Chair.
Senator Langset.
It appears to me that people are going to be working longer, particularly because of the medical care thing. A lot of people that talked about 62 now are thinking they got to get to 65 because there's that hole there that they can't get by. And then I think people are healthier. I mean, I had my 71st birthday yesterday. And
congratulations.
Happy birthday.
And I feel good. In fact, my mother, who's almost 93, feels good, too. So I think people are going to be working considerably longer. And what I see a lot of people, they'll say, I'm going to quit at 62. Then they get there. And then, well, they can go another year. And first thing you know, it's 65. But that 65 really does seem to be the one they're going to have to get to if they can have the health and so on to get there because of that medical.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Langseth, I think what you suggest is has some truth in it. But I think the overwhelming trend is that we are going to have more elderly, and we're going to have more students, and we're going to have less people to pay for them. Now, how big that is remains to be debated, and we'll see as we get there. But the overall trend, I think, is significant.
Finding four on the bottom of page 10. Despite continuing to rank high among many key social and economic indicators, Minnesota's economy has underperformed recently relative to the nation.
We don't have a chart for this particular one, and it's a trend that we're not convinced either is going to continue or is not going to continue. We're frankly in a wait and see with Minnesota's economy to see if it comes out of this anemia that it's in and rises again to outpace the national economy as it has traditionally since the 60s, or whether we have the start of something more troubling where we underperform the national economy.
But the bottom line finding on this, and is based on this finding, the commission's recommendation is be careful about assuming that you're going to have the economic bounce back that we've had in past years and outperforming the country when dealing with the budget. Finding five, demographic and economic factors will lead to lower growth of state's tax revenues over the next 25 years.
If you look at the bottom of page 12, you see the growth rates that we projected. And I should say that this is the first time that the state of Minnesota and the Minnesota Management Budget Group has done a 25-year projection of revenues and expenditures. And you can see by the chart, we're expecting overall state revenues to grow at the rate of 3.9%. Could it be 4%? Absolutely. Could it be 3.5%? Absolutely. But this was the best attempt at doing a long-range projection, and that was 3.9%.
Finding six is Minnesota has a long-term structural budget problem with long-term expenditure growth likely to outpace revenue growth.
And I think the chart on page 13 shows this very well. Again, in addition to doing the revenue projection over 25 years, we did the expenditure projection over 25 years. And we know going into this period that public health care costs have been rising faster than the other state expenditures. We also know that K-12 expenditures have been rising faster, but also that there'll be an increasing population both for the health care and for the education dollars, given the demographics. We suggest that all other spending would be at the 2.7% level, slightly less than inflation, so the total spending would be at 5.4%. Again, is it 5.2, 5.6? These are estimates. I think the bottom line, though, is that it appears that spending for the state will outpace revenue over the next 25 years, given the dynamics of the state, what's happening with the economy, and what's happening with our key expenditure items.
So Mr. Krodowski, how much of that is attributable to the fact that we went on a tax cutting kind of on a frenzy? I mean, when I came to the legislature in 1994, and former Representative Goodenow was in the House with me, it seems to me I remember a time where we had 14 budget forecasts in a row where revenue exceeded projections. And I think the first tax cut that I remember participating in serving on the House Tax Committee, and Senator Rest, I think, chaired the committee at the time, we did a 20, if you brought in, when you did your income tax, if you brought in your property tax statement, you got a 20% refund of the property taxes that you paid. And then we went on to two different rounds of income tax cuts, the Jesse checks that most people probably don't remember what they did with it, but it was billions of dollars probably, and the 2001 school takeover shifted to the general fund. It just seems like, to what extent did the pendulum maybe swing too far, and now we've created this, the legislature actually created this structural imbalance because revenue just kept coming in over what we were forecasting it.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we do have a finding that, in fact, Minnesota has a structural budget deficit. And clearly that is true going forward. We unfortunately ran out of time to answer every question that we had, but I'll just speak personally. And we've seen this pattern occur since the 80s. It was Governor Quay in the 80s in which We thought we had a lot of revenues early in his term. We made some changes, and then by the end of the term, we again went through forecast after forecast and had to increase taxes and cut expenditures repeatedly because of the recession that occurred. People have asked me specifically about this time period, and I would say 1999 is the year that we'd love to dial back to. That was the best of times in Minnesota. Then Commissioner of Finance Pam Wheelock said we had boatloads of money. And if you think about it, it was when the economy was the very best in the nation and in Minnesota. And so what the governor and the legislature did at that point was to reduce taxes and also to increase expenditures. It was bifold actions. We did both in the expectation, frankly, that revenues would continue at the pace that they were going at in 1999. Well, that was unrealistic. That was the best of years, and normal years and less than normal years were fast approaching, so that by 2003, the legislature found itself with a substantial budget deficit. We had a little bit of an uptick in the economy that gave us some money, but if you recall, 2 years ago, a lot of it was one-time money. And now with the severe recession, we clearly are out of money. So I believe, and again, it's a personal view, that since 1999, the state of Minnesota has had a structural budget deficit. That is, we simply didn't have, in a normal year, the revenues to pay for all of the expenditures that we had enacted.
Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That being said, and acknowledging that other states, many other states, are facing budget deficits, some structural and some one-time, perhaps, are there any best practices that are being used in other states, particularly to curb health care costs in a way that does not negatively impact the health of our citizens or increase costs because we have, short-term solutions where we knock people off of programs and then they end up going to hospital emergency care, and then we have hospitals going under or not getting the reimbursements that they need, or the counties and uncompensated care, and so it's just a vicious circle. Are there any states that we can go to school on?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, no. We can pick up ideas.
I'm sorry my question was so long.
We can pick up ideas from states as far as little things that they do to manage the budget, but the reality is that Minnesota as a state is relatively unique out there in the way and how and to the extent that we provide health care to our citizens. We have an infrastructure in the state, healthcare infrastructure in the state, that has developed around the way we provide services to people in the state. And that's the difficulty. When you start pulling out the state part of that infrastructure, then it does impact the whole healthcare system. One thing to keep in mind with the 8.5% increase on healthcare, that includes Medicaid. That includes more than just acute health care. I mean, the health care that you think of when you have your health care insurance. It also includes the health care coverage and the medical assistance coverage for people with disabilities and elderly and frail elderly. So it goes beyond just your basic health care services. And as a state, we made a decision many years ago to be very aggressive in moving people out of institutions and moving them into the communities. And there's a cost to that. And there's a cost of that obligation and that decision that we made as policymakers back then, that this is an important thing for the state, it's an important thing for the citizens of the state, that we don't house people in institutions, that we make sure people are integrated within the community. That is part of the challenge in dealing and looking at best practices in other states, because other states haven't had that strong of a commitment to in that aspect, in other aspects as far as providing health care.
That trend of moving people out of institutions followed the Community Mental Health Act that was a federal trend. So that's not particularly unique to Minnesota, although maybe we did it faster or more completely than other states. But when you look at the 8.5% increase, how much of that is the ongoing care for people with disabilities waivered services rather than what we tend to think of that as the either the general health care and or nursing home care.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, I can't speak to the 25-year trend and how that is broken out. What I can speak to is that in the recent years, when you look at the biennial forecasted increase in spending in the HHS, the Human Services budget, which usually is about $1 billion to $1.5 billion, just automatic increase. If you break it down for this last biennium, it's basically the long-term care cost, the facility costs that would be institutional, ICFMRs and nursing homes, is relatively flat. The growth factors are in, right now, Medicaid for families and with children, so low-income families and children, and that's going up because of the economy. There's growth with regard to the waivered services, and if you look at the growth there, there's different waivered services out there, and it's people, the CADI waiver is where the biggest growth is, and that's developed to serve people with mental health issues and other types of issues. But there's also acuity factors. There's a lot more to it. And then the other third goes to MA, medical assistance, basic care for elderly and disabled. So you have a waiver pot, you have a basic pot, and then you have families and children, and they're all growing right now. And why are they growing? Basically because there's more people enrolling in the programs, number one. And number two, the people that are coming onto the programs have higher needs. When we talked about the trend of people aging, that's true with people on disability and people who start off on Medicaid when they're children. We're trying to come up with information. It was a group that I'm working with, but 20 years ago, the average age of somebody with Down syndrome was in the 20s, maybe 30s. Now, 50s, 60s. So people with disabilities are living longer lives. They're experiencing chronic diseases like the rest of us, and those chronic diseases and manage those with the other issues that they're dealing with. It's a cost to the system. So it is part of the demographic trend, but I don't think it's fair to say it's just the disabled. It's the whole system that's out there.
So just finally, so Mr. Chairman, so it's unrealistic for if we're going to take care of this of these populations, not to expect that kind of increase just for accounting for their people with chronic illnesses getting older. We can't shut the spigot off on them. So that number is not outrageous. It is just what's going to be.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ress, I almost went back to the Representative Ress. I think that's partially true. There is some health care inflation aspects to this as well, I think, over the trend. So, I mean, it's not as easy to break it down, but I think what you say is substantially correct. The trends are based off of current law and include inflation into those trends. Mm-hmm. But so if you change current law on how we fund, for example, senior services, if it's funded through a different mechanism, then that can impact these costs. So, but this is a trend based on current law plus inflation being factored into it.
And healthcare inflation being higher than regular inflation.
Okay. Next finding, we've actually just talked about it, healthcare growth will become the most important factor in controlling rising state expenditures in the future.
Before we move on, Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to follow up on what Senator Ress was saying because I think she hit the nail on the head. It's our health care portion of the budget is growing faster than anything else, and it seems to me that if we're going to bring it down, the approach that's been done in recent years is to slow down the rate of growth by cutting back eligibility. And if we're going to keep trying that over a 10-year period with the demographics, we're going to make things a whole lot more miserable for a whole lot of people. And that there is another approach, and that is that maybe looking at some of the things like if we did a more comprehensive mental health care system with community stuff, you wouldn't have people bouncing where they come out of a state, out of institution from hospitalization or something. They go out in the community, have no services whatsoever, then they're back in the hospital. If we did some more with pregnancy prevention, family planning, I don't know what it is, 40% of the kids who are born today are on MA. And if we did some pregnancy prevention for some teenagers, it seems to me we got two choices, one of which is to say we're going to just keep cutting back on what people get, which makes the system more dysfunctional and more painful for people, or we step in and we say we're going to try and solve some of the problems and prevent everybody from bouncing back into the most expensive care, which I got to say, with mental health, I've seen so many people who are hospitalized because they had no community service.
Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, that's true. I mean, the basic, and I think that's why Minnesota is an outlier compared to other states, because we've recognized that many years ago. GAMC program that we have in the state of Minnesota is a unique program. I mean, very few states have a program that's targeted at adults without dependent children that's 100% state funded. That program was set up based on your philosophy and what you're saying. We expanded the coverage of family planning issues under Medicaid a number of years ago with the idea that we would save money in the end by trying to prevent children coming on MA. But those decisions that we made also make us outliers when it comes to these cost issues and the drivers that are in the system, because there is a cost to that as well. And, you know, it's one of the challenges that we have to look at. And if you look at the recommendation, and I'll just move to the recommendation on health care, we did not have the time, the expertise, or at that point the desire to look at. We knew that health care is a problem. We couldn't come up with a good solution for you. So we actually suggested setting up a commission to look at the health care costs specific to the state budget. And so they would make recommendations with regard to the Medicaid program about how you can save money in the future, but also manage it in such a way that you actually will see better services to people rather than fewer services. It's an imperfect solution. It's the best one we could come up with without delving into that tremendously. So,
Mr. Chair, just one follow-up, and that is that I think you're right. We did do better than some other states, but not a lot better. And I'd say the biggest gap is not that we did a much better job in family planning. We did far less than we could have done, which means our MA population is going to continue to grow. And the other alternative for way of saving money on MA is to just cut back benefits, which means you have a sicker population. And frankly, with health care, often not treating the problem doesn't make it go away. It makes it get worse. And so every time we cut back on this rate of growth, we cut back on it, we mean we're delivering fewer services and making sicker people. And frankly, I'd argue our budget problems now are some of the things we did 4 or 5 years ago.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Marty, I don't disagree with you on that, at least not on everything. The next item, number 8, state revenue volatility will make long-term budget instability more difficult to manage.
You have three different charts you can look at on pages 19 and or 20. You can look at the long-term trend of, and just look at the what I've come to call the roller coaster line at the top of page 19 of our surpluses and our deficits, our surpluses and our deficits, our normal times, our surpluses, our deficits, et cetera. A very volatile pattern.
Before you go there, we do have fighting 9 in there too, which is Minnesota's revenue fund tax base has grown more volatile in the past decade.
Okay. Correct. Page 20. You can see by the numbers that the corporate income tax is the most volatile of the taxes, with the sales tax being the least volatile, but only, well, representing 31% of the tax base versus the income tax with its volatility being 48% of it. Of the tax base. And then you can look at the bottom of page 20 and you can just see graphically that volatility. They have changed slightly over time, but the general pattern is that our other revenue and corporate income tax is the most volatile, with the income tax and the sales tax being the next most volatile. What's not shown on the chart is property taxes. And you can look at the page 21 and see that our property tax has been the most stable of our taxes. But we don't use it as heavily as other states use the property tax, hence the greater volatility in Minnesota versus other states.
Findings 10 and 11, I want to make sure I say this correctly, because there's a lot of time spent by the economists making sure that every word was correct on this. So rather than enduring their wrath, I'm going to get this right. Replacing highly volatile tax-based components with less volatile sources could reduce the volatility of the overall general fund tax system. However, such changes would also affect revenue growth rates and the distribution of the tax burden among taxpayers. And let me just go into finding 11 before we go on. Finding 11 is adjusting the mix of the current tax base while remaining revenue growth rate neutral cannot significantly reduce revenue volatility without a dramatic reweighting of tax revenue sources and a radical change in the tax rates to the system.
if you want to have a major impact in reducing the tax volatility in Minnesota, these two findings in essence say you have to take a major change, you have to make a major change in which taxes you use in which proportions. Minnesota, as I indicated, uses the property tax less than other states. It uses the income tax more than other states, with the corporate and the sales tax less than other states. You'd have to dramatically change our mix if you really wanted to reduce volatility. And the commission is not recommending that. One, we didn't think we should, one way or another. But secondly, it has been Minnesota's tradition for a long time to have this form of tax system. The notion that you could tinker with the tax system, for instance, adding a sales tax on clothing and a sales tax on personal services, we found no evidence that suggested that would dramatically change the volatility. And I was surprised. I came on the commission believing that an extension of the sales tax would, in fact, make our system less volatile. We were not able to find solid evidence that that would be the case. In fact, it appears that adding clothing and personal services, it might act much like the existing sales tax. And then you also have to look at the interaction it has with the other taxes. And again, for the first time, the state of Minnesota did this volatility study in which it looked at the interaction of the taxes, not just at the individual volatility of the taxes. So we looked at the volatility of the entire system.
Now, we shifted. A few findings ago, we were talking about the growth in the revenues versus the growth in expenditures. Now we're talking about volatility. If you look back on the chart on page 20 that shows the trend growth rate for the different tax categories and then the volatility of those categories, if you're trying to do something with regard to the growth rate and increase the growth rate on the tax base, then you're looking at corporate income tax and other revenue based on this chart. If you look at the volatility of those two, though, is then you add volatility to the system. If you're trying to reduce the volatility, then you want to put in more stable tax types. When you do that, then you reduce your growth rate. And so you really have to focus on what problem are you trying to solve, and just you have to understand that they're interactive. One other thing that I guess it's been a while since I've been on a tax committee, so it surprised me, was when you look at volatile tax bases or volatile taxes, you have to be careful because if you remove one volatile tax out of the system, you may not actually reduce the volatility in the system. You may actually increase it, because what there are taxes that kind of interact with each other. When one's going up, the other one's going down, and together they're relatively stable. But if you take one of those out, then the system itself becomes more volatile.
It's in investments, it's called portfolio theory, and you can, well, best example is, I'll ask you the question. If you had a 100% bond portfolio, or you had a portfolio that had 60% bonds and 40% stocks, which one would be more volatile? Which one do you think would be more volatile?
Single A.
Sounds like a trick question.
Most people would suggest the 100% bond would be the least volatile. In fact, adding stocks to a bond portfolio to a certain extent makes it less volatile than an only bond portfolio. And it's some of those interactions that occur within the tax system that you have to be very careful about, because of the correlation between the taxes.
So on the issue of the sales tax expansion, the commission could not find any evidence that would solve a volatility problem. But it does, if you're worried about the erosion of the tax base in the future, you know, it may solve that problem. So there might be other reasons why you want to do it, but the volatility is not one of those. Yeah. Right. Finding number 12, shifting consumption patterns have reduced Minnesota's sales tax base.
Not much to say there other than it's a fact, and you can think about the internet sales and other things that might be doing that.
Finding 13, Minnesota's statutory budget reserve ceiling has not grown to an appropriate level to adequately manage the underlying risks in Minnesota's tax system over time.
Again, for the first time, the commission, and again, it was the staff of the Minnesota Management and Budget, did an analysis to determine, given the volatility we've had in state revenues, statistically, what would the budget reserve have to be in order to handle that volatility? Sitting around the room that day when we were talking about this, somebody asked, well, where did the size of the budget reserve come from? And we had to go all the way back, I think, to Gus Donahoe in my tenure in the finance department when we picked out of the air 5% because we thought we could afford 5% in those days of a $10 billion budget, $500 million. It seemed right. And, well, that 5% somehow just became it became what people thought needed to be the case. But then we got to the point where that was too large a number, and so we ended up in that 750, 800 is kind of the goal. Well, statistically, we now know that on the chart on page 24 would suggest essentially 2.1, somewhere in that range of $2 billion to $2.3 billion would be needed over a four-year budget period. That is, if you started with that money at the beginning and you had a structurally balanced budget, 19 out of 20 times you would survive that four-year period without having to call the legislature into session and do something with the budget. If you wanted to cover it for a two-year period, it's essentially $1.5 billion. In other words, if you start the biennium with a structurally balanced budget and you have in the bank $1.5 billion in reserves, you ought to, 19 out of 20 times, get to the end of that two-year period without having to have a special session and adjust your revenues and expenditures.
So, Mr. Kordalski, does the cash flow account, is that part of the budget reserve, or is that outside of it?
It's outside of it. And you'll see that in a minute in our recommendations. We're recommending both the cash flow reserve account and the budget reserve.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Kordalski, to get to $1.5 billion, given that you've got a structurally balanced budget, doesn't assume that you've made any changes in reducing the volatility of the incidence of the taxes in the tax. So, if you reduced the volatility of the tax system, would that then lead to a fiscally sound budget reserve? I don't mean the cash flow account, but a fiscally sound budget reserve account of a lesser number, either the number you'd pick for 4 years or 2 years?
Yes, with the two caveats that the major way to do that would be to increase the use of property taxes, mm-hmm. and reduce the use of corporate and individual income taxes. And secondly, that you'll reduce the overall growth rate of revenues for the state going forward.
Thank you.
The final finding, then we'll go on to the recommendations, is that Minnesota needs a cash flow reserve account of sufficient size so that the state can avoid short-term external borrowing during the biennium.
Yeah, I was in the Department of Finance when we implemented the first external borrowing program in 1983. I don't recommend it. We were downgraded from AAA to AA at that point. Fortunately, we were able to reduce that program ended in 1983, but it took us till the 90s under Arnie Carlson to get the AAA credit rating back. It's something you just don't want to do as a state.
Recommendations start on page 26, and they're found in three broad categories. The first broad category is provide decision makers and citizens with the necessary information to make informed budget and policy decisions.
First one is to create a permanent long-range planning function in state government. We're not suggesting here necessarily bringing back the state planning agency. What we are concerned about, though, is that there is enough emphasis placed on the demographic projections,
yeah.
and regularly doing financial projections of the state's future. That had not been done, and again, the first time the 25-year projection had been done, it was part of the work of our commission. That needs to be happening regularly so we know what the future looks like and we can plan for it. The second recommendation is to release a demographic forecast at the start of each biennium. In looking at the demographics, we were really surprised by some of the demographic changes we see coming in Minnesota, and we weren't certain that the Minnesota public, nor the legislature, nor the governor were fully appreciative of some of those trends. We'd like to see the demographic forecast, or projection, if you will, be raised to a higher visibility, and we thought a good way of doing that was every 2 years have a release similar to the release that occurs with the budget forecast. In other words, a lot of attention paid to what is demographically happening in our state and what are the implications for the state as a result of those projections? Third one is financial forecasts should be based on current law and inflation or deflation of both revenues and expenditures to provide an accurate planning perspective. And then it also goes on to say, however, budgets should not automatically fund inflation allowances based, base spending should be scrutinized. The footnote suggests we did have a couple of members that would only sign, actually we had one member that would only sign the report if we footnoted the dissent on this. We think a lot has been made of this over time. We don't want to wade into the dispute. We do think that it makes sense to do projections, including inflation, which our 25-year projections did do. But when it comes to budgeting, you never have to, in fact, fund inflation. That's a choice that policymakers make, both the governor and the legislature.
And just as a word, in the just to do a the way the MMB has suggested doing this is maybe too blunt an instrument, but you need a little bit more fine-tuning and adding inflation to the forecast. For example, there are programs within the Health and Human Services that already have inflation factored into them just by the way their budgeting is done. So you won't want to put inflation on top of something that already had inflation put into it. So I think it works if it's fine-tuned, but if it's not fine-tuned, then it's more of a blunt instrument that doesn't really give you an accurate picture. It's just more dollars. So the next broad area is achieve long-term balance of state revenues and expenditures.
The first recommendation on page 27 was to minimize tax exemption deductions and credits unless necessary for federal conformity. One of the reasons the tax system has become more volatile is we have allowed certain tax exemptions, deductions, and credits, which make it more volatile. So you can reduce some the volatility by being conscious of the decisions you're making as it relates to volatility. The next recommendation is a key recommendation, and that's to help the governor and the legislature manage long-term obligations. The state should begin by spending no more in the current biennial budget than can be supported by ongoing revenues. In other words, the legislature and the governor need to get to the point of approving structurally balanced budgets. Last session, the legislature left. The governor made no point of this, that there was an unbalanced budget. As we looked out to fiscal years 10 and 11, there was $1 billion unfunded as we looked at fiscal years 10 and 11, i.e., you left last session with a structurally unbalanced budget. We're suggesting that the legislature and the governor should not do that.
So, Mr. Kudelski, you're telling us we shouldn't assume we're going to grow our way out of the problem?
Correct.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, that follows up on my point, which is it's a little disappointing on page 27 under your general summary here, achieve long-term balance of state revenues and expenditures. One of your sentences says that we will be required to reduce spending or increase revenues. And I think what you're really telling us is we can't count on those revenues to continue to grow. In fact, they're declining. And so that leaves this little option, but to either cut spending or cut spending and increase revenues. But I don't think that we can just increase revenues as they are declining.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ortman, one of the reasons this bipartisan or tripartisan commission was able to reach conclusions is that very early in the process we realized that there were some of us that wanted to reduce taxes, and there were some of us that thought we needed to increase expenditures. When we realized that both of those positions are a problem, it got to be very easy for the commission to do its work. We simply always included reduce revenues and increase expenditures are a problem, or the way to solve this is to increase revenues and decrease expenditures. It's always an and. And that allowed the commission to complete its work. It's your policy choice whether you want to do both, do one or the other. It's your choice. We're suggesting that the budget should be balanced on an ongoing basis.
And, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, to that point, Jay said is absolutely correct, and that was a position that we took, is that, you know, we're taking a step back from the public policy aspect of it and looking at technically where is the problem. The problem is that expenditures are growing at a faster rate than your revenues are. So you can solve that. If you solve this problem this year, but you're not solving it by either reducing the reducing expenditures that are the high growth rate, or by raising taxes that are, well, if you increase taxes and you still have the same growth rate on the taxes, and you decrease expenditures and you still have the same growth rate on expenditures, next biennium you're going to be out of balance. Because on the trend line, your expenditures are still growing faster than your revenues. So if you want to solve that problem, you either have to try to figure out how to bring the growth rate down in your expenditures, or you need to figure out how to increase your growth rate on the tax side. And we understand that on the tax side, you have the issue of if you get the growth rate going up, then you add to the volatility problem, and you also have the issue with progressivity. So you have to figure out every one interacts with the other. On the spending side, same thing. Going back to Senator Marty's comments, you start ratcheting back on the highest growth areas. These are some of the more vulnerable people that will be impacted by those decisions, at least in the short term. How do you manage that going forward? You can cut spending, $5 billion this year. I'm not suggesting that, but you can cut spending $5 billion this year and still have the same problem next year because the growth rate is still there. So if anything, I came out of this commission a lot more pessimistic and cynical about where we are in the future. But I know that Minnesota has always risen to the occasion and addressed those issues. And I also know that Minnesota, compared to other states, does pretty well. We are very hard on ourselves, though, when we think we need to do a lot better than we're doing right now.
So. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goodnow, when you talk about the expenditure growth rate, in Minnesota, or probably even in the country, aren't we compounding our growth rate with the governmental costs that relate to health care? In every part of our budget is related to people who have health insurance costs that are going up, double digit here and there. We provide the care for those that can't afford it, so those costs are going up. And did you guys look at all about whether the overall health care inflation rate is going to moderate, which would then compound those expenditures downwards? Did you look at that at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Skoy, no. We did not have time to delve into the details of that. I would just have you say, just in the last 5 years with my involvement on the Medicaid budget, that typically there's inflation, healthcare inflation included in part of the budget related to arguably your healthier population that we serve as a state, because that's more the Minnesota Care Program and the healthier Medicaid program. Well, folks on Medicaid, they go through managed care, and the way those contracts are set out, there's an inflationary factor factored into that. But for those people who are elderly and disabled, they've basically been on a fee for service. The state sets the rates we pay. So we can control that factor of the inflation in the sense that we say this is what the provider pays, and they're not going to get more until the state says we're going to pay you more. So if you look at the breakdown of where the increase are coming from, it's been you have some health care inflation, but you have more people coming on the system, and that's been a trend, for quite a while. And then you have the fact that they have higher needs. They're more costly. And so it's those three factors. And so it's really not fair to compare our health care growth to health care growth in the regular acute care system, because we control some of our costs there.
Thank you.
Mr. Goodnow, would it be cheaper for the state to create some kind of a tax credit program for a parent that wants to stay home and take care of that disabled youth than it is to put them in some kind of a waivered service program?
Mr. Chairman, an interesting question, and I think the program that we can look at that gives us some of the best information on that is Alternative Care, which is a program that's a state program that's targeted at trying to help maintain senior citizens in their homes when they're at risk of going into a nursing home facility. When that program was first established, the success rate, in other words, the number of people accessing the program that actually were going to go into a nursing home was figured to be, I think, 1 to 4. For every 4 people on the program, you kept 1 person out of a nursing home. As the program expanded and as time went on, those numbers, that ratio got higher. So maybe for every 8 people on the program, you kept 1 person out of a nursing home. I'm pulling those out of there. I'm not sure if that's those exact numbers, so don't quote me on those. But that was the kind of the trend. So what you have when you do something like that is a woodwork effect. Is are there people that would take care of their parents in their homes anyway that now are going to access the tax credit, and you're spending money on those as well. So, you know, I don't know if we have good data to show, but I think the fact is you have a lot of people that are already taking that responsibility and may access state programs when you put the state program in place. So that's the concern that you have to look at when you do that.
Mr. Chairman, let me try to get through the recommendations before I have to leave, and Kevin can follow up and answer more of your questions if you wouldn't mind. On page 28, the second recommendation, any additional one-time revenue should be used strictly for building reserves, paying off shifts, capital projects, or other one-time purposes. The 2005 legislature did a good job of thinking about what would happen if they did get more money. The budget reserve was built back up, the shifts were bought back, and some dollars were used for one-time purposes. So that's the kind of action you need to take when, in fact, you have excess revenue simply from the economy being better than the long-term economy in the state. If you use that money to reduce taxes or build up expenditures, you just are compounding the problem for the next time the state gets to normality or dips down into a recessionary period, because that's when you have to do the cutting or tax increasing. The next one is expenditure forecast should include information about rates of growth by expenditure area. Just help you understand where the budget is growing. The next one is very important. The governor and the legislature should create a structurally balanced budget for the current and following biennium. What that would mean this year is that for the 2010 and 11 biennial budget, you obviously by constitution have to balance that. But you should also have a spreadsheet that's interactive with the current budget that says what would the budget look like in the following biennium, the 12-13 biennium. Just truly have a structural balanced budget, both biennium would have to show surpluses or zeros on the bottom line. Tough chore. The governor and legislature should create a structurally balanced budget for the, when making budgetary decisions to achieve a balance of expenditures and revenues, the governor and legislature should consider the impact of shifting the expenditure burden to the private sector or local units of government. The commission realized that as we talked about the property tax and the interaction of state budget with local budgets, that the worst thing the legislature can do is simply shift the problem to local government and say that they've solved the problem. You need to be mindful of that. I won't say any more.
And the next finding is with regard to the health care commission that I talked about earlier.
So if you go to the next page, top of page 29, as we talked about the finding that fewer people today are graduating from high school, and we also are going to have a more diverse population occurring, we're suggesting that we need to address the educational attainment gap in the current K-12 system, because we need as many productive workers as we can in that workforce, particularly when we get to the point that there are fewer workers than there are people not working. So it's kind of self-intuitive, I think.
The next and the last broad recommendation area is manage the state budget volatility. So if you make the decision that you can only, you can't really change the volatility of the state of the state tax system substantially unless you make major changes to the tax system. Then our task said, we said, well, if we can't do that, then how do we manage the volatility in the system?
The first recommendation is one of the key recommendations of the report. If forecast revenues exceed trend line revenue growth should be the basis for the spending decisions. The four commissioners of finance that served on this commission realized during our discussions that we had done a disservice to the state. Not intentionally, but unintentionally, because when times were good, we went with the tradition of having the state forecast use Global Insights assumptions, and they pointed this way. Until this past spring, Global Insights never projected a recession. So we were necessarily setting ourselves up with a false economy and ultimately a fall. So what we, as the four commissioners of finance, stepped forward and said to the rest of the commission, we need to change this process so that in good times we need to go with the not Global Insights projection of prosperity forever, which gets us into trouble, but look at the trend line of growth for the state and use that trend line of growth, which will be less than the Global Insights forecast, which will take some money off the table that would preclude you from spending it on tax reductions or expenditure increases, which would cause future budget imbalances. So it's the thing that everybody's always said to commissioners of finance and state economists, why in good times do you always overforecast? And this recommendation says in good times we've got to stop doing that and only project forward the long-term trend growth of revenues. And if the money comes in, great. But if it doesn't come in, then we don't have to go to a special session and do special cutting of the budget or tax increases.
This recommendation would be a major change in the way you currently budget. And again, looking at using the long-term trend line, if the you have the long-term trend line like this, but you have the economy going like this over the period of time, at any time that the revenues are above that trend line, you can't spend that any of those revenues above the trend line until actually it's brought in and you spend it on one-time purposes. If it's below the trend line, then you have to go to what's below the trend line, of course, because that's what your reality is and what you have to do with the constitutional budget.
That is a major paradigm shift.
It is. And the challenge that we've had, and go back to 1999, and I was one of those big spenders back then, being chair of the Health and Human Services Committee, we were projecting, we had a snapshot of 4 years. This is what the trend line is. We didn't think about what happened in the fifth year when it goes down again. So we were spending based on this and cutting taxes based on this, and yet in the end of the fourth year, things started going down. This trend line will help us manage that, and it would be a major paradigm shift.
But a necessary one. Just because we've always done it a certain way doesn't mean we should continue to do it that way.
Sure.
Well, I remember somebody running for governor saying, you've been overtaxed, it's your money, I'm going to send it back to you. I mean, how do you avoid that? Of course, there's a natural temptation to add spending when there's some additional money around. So, I mean,
it would take the discipline, Mr. Chairman, of the governor and the legislative leaders to enforce this. It can be done.
And, Mr. Chairman, it's a lot easier to say it on this side of the table than on that side of the table.
Senator Pogemiller. Is there a chart you can point to that would demonstrate the point you're just making?
Well, if you look at the graph on page 19, you can clearly see the volatility of our tax base. And part of that, we got into the trap of just thinking in, 1979, 1980, we were forecasting more money than was going to come in. And the reason we were doing that is because our national forecaster gives us assumptions that things are going to remain relatively good.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
That doesn't quite show us the
trend
line.
It does not.
I was looking if there's a chart in here that demonstrates that.
No, we did not create such a chart.
But you'd probably suggest that someone create that chart.
Okay.
Right?
It'd probably be a good idea.
Would you suggest that?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. The next recommendation, permanent tax reductions or expenditure increases should only be undertaken under certain circumstances. And the circumstance would be that you have demonstrated that you have a balanced budget, structurally balanced budget for the current biennium and the following biennium, and you have excess revenues over expenditures. In that case, you do have money to spend. You need to spend it in a way that you don't put your out biennium into deficit. So it's just more fiscal discipline that's required. Let me conclude with the recommendations on the budget reserve and the cash flow accounts down at the bottom of page 29. In essence, says that the Department of Finance should regularly calculate the necessary size of the budget reserve given the volatility of our tax system and statistic probabilities. For the current situation on the top of page 30, we understand that to be $2.1 billion for the four-year period or $1.5 billion for a two-year period. If the budget reserve is depleted in the current biennium, it should be replenished within two biennia. Cash flow account should be maintained separate from the budget reserve to avoid that short-term borrowing. And then we've also suggested the Minnesota Management and Budget have actually calculate what the size of that cash flow account should be depending on the budget that's being recommended. So our expectation is when the governor makes his budget recommendation, the department will have a recommendation on the size of the cash flow account based on those recommendations to keep us from having to borrow externally for the course of the next biennium.
One thing to note on the cash flow account is that in order to avoid external short-term borrowing, MMB borrows from internal funds. And so if you have fund balances that used to be there that they used to rely on for that short-term borrowing, and because of whatever budget you put forward takes those funds away or depletes those funds, then your cash flow account needs will go up. And what we're saying is that the cash flow account should be based on the premise that we should avoid external short-term borrowing and that it should be based on the decisions that you're making with internally within the budget. On a note on the budget reserve, one of the challenges and one of the frustrations I've always had is that you have a budget reserve. I know I'm shifting to the other one, a budget reserve set up to help you through the tough times. And I think the commission still says that, you know, you shouldn't ignore what's happening with the budget just because you have the budget reserve. If there are some corrections that need to be made, make the corrections. But you have the ability then to use the budget reserve to help manage your way through the budget while you're making those corrections, and those corrections take place and you can get the savings. But it was always frustrating for me was that we were using the budget reserves in time of need, but then at the same time you were cutting the budgets and using the budget reserves, you had the pressure to replenish the budget reserves immediately. And to me, there's something wrong with that scenario. So,
yeah, Mr. Chairman, let me make some concluding remarks, and then I do have to go. I teach at 11 o'clock, and so I've got to get to my students. This recommendation, this is the third time that I've served on a commission or an effort to make recommendations to the legislature on how to handle fiscal volatility. I hope this, the third time, is the charm. I hope I don't have to serve on a fourth one. Essentially, what you have in front of you are recommendations that you can enact this session that don't cost you any money, but lays out the game plan for the next period of recovery that would allow you to position the states such that you didn't have to have a crisis when the U.S. economy faced a recession. We're not suggesting that you appropriate this year $1.5 billion or $2.1 billion of budget reserve. We know that that's not possible given your circumstances. But it is possible for you to put into statute that any excess dollars that come in could go into the budget reserve. And ultimately, the budget reserve needs to be built to $1.5 billion for a two-year period. You can choose if you want to build it to $2.1 billion for a four-year period. You can change the forecasting methodology such that the department is directed the next time to use the next time that the global insights assumptions are in excess of the long-term trend of Minnesota's revenue, that the state does use and the state economist does use the long-term trend. You can also, this session, as you're working on your budget solution, look at the impact on the 2012-2013 biennium and see to what extent are you solving the structural problem, or are you simply patching together something to get out of here knowing full well that you're going to face further problems either next legislative session or the following legislative session. This system has been built over a number of years. We've made a number of improvements to reduce and improve the management of the state, things like the cash flow reserve, things like accepting the forecast, financial forecasts of the state. But our work isn't done. We do have to do more to ensure that we don't face a $5.2 billion or close to 15% deficit in the budget the next time the state has a recovery and then goes into recession. So I can answer one or two quick questions, and then Kevin can respond to the other questions.
Mr. Chair.
Sir Langston.
Mr. Chair, if you look back on the mistakes we made, and I did think it was a mistake at the time when the state took over 100% of the foundation aid. Most legislators would say that 40% is the most important part of the budget, and we were putting it on this extremely volatile revenue base. And I remember saying at the time, well, if we're going to do this, let's go to 95%, not 100%. So you don't totally divorce it, and you can move it around. Now, of course, it is a matter of policy. We pick it all up. Now to try to go back on that, of course, is going to be very tough politically. But it sure seems to me that if I look back over the last 10 years, that was the biggest mistake we made. Extremely popular, obviously. But I think it was a very big mistake.
It was a commitment, Mr. Chairman, Senator Langseth, that the legislature made that it couldn't uphold through bad times.
Yeah.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to point out, I think we have gone back. I think, you know, we've carved off pieces of we've carved pieces out of the foundation and given school districts authority to levy locally. We've expanded their ability to levy locally. So it feels like we have largely gone back. Just a comment. I appreciated, you know, some of the recommendations that said, you know, let's make sure that we're investing in the long term, address education attainment gaps in the current K-12 system, you know, so that workers will be supporting future economic growth. You know, there's a lot of recommendations about how to manage the budget and the numbers, but you know, with Senator Marty and others, we've had some policy discussions. We are somewhat in control of our own destiny here, and you know, we don't have to accept all of these trends as written in stone and given. Some of what we do vis-a-vis the university and investments in research and the future economy, what we do with our future workforce, what we do with healthcare, can change this picture in a lot of ways, and it's not going to be just simply about budget reserves and credit ratings and that sort of thing. That's some of the going to be some of the art as contrasted with some of the science that's in this report, and I think we need to have some of those conversations as well.
Senator Ortman.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and Mr. Goodnow, to what extent did the group look at the corporate income tax base volatility, and can it be attributed to legislative changes or to economic factors or both? Is there more information about that?
I think what you see is what you get in the sense that we didn't look at what caused the volatility, and we looked at the taxes and were they volatile and what the growth rates were. It's, you know, the corporate income tax, of course, is volatile because of if they have earnings. I mean, you're going to be paying it. If they don't have earnings, they don't. So if you're in a time of recession or where a lot of businesses are failing, of course it's going to go down. And so I think that's part of the volatility with the income tax system. On the other hand, arguably it's a more progressive system. You know, so it's, you know, it's choices that have to be made as to what you value with regard to growth, volatility, and progressivity in the system.
Thank you.
But doesn't the corporate tax, Mr. Goodwin, doesn't the corporate tax, to some extent, isn't that exported outside of the state?
Okay. Mr. Chairman, I'm just going to defer to your expertise in this.
I'd ask that question of Mr. Kradowski, who's still here.
Yeah, he took off before you could get that one out.
Representative Rukavina says from time to time, don't tax me, tax the man behind the tree. And to the extent, I think most of us, as a matter of tax policy, would rather put as much of that burden on people that are not residents of the state, if that's possible. And we talk about corporate tax volatility, but the truth is corporate taxes are paid by corporate headquarters. And so to the extent that Walmart pays corporate taxes in Minnesota, is that burden paid in Birmingham, Alabama, or where is Walmart at?
It's in Arkansas, Mr. Chair.
Arkansas?
Yes, Bentonville.
Or Wells Fargo's corporate taxes paid by San Francisco? I mean, I do think there's a question about how much of the corporate tax burden, even though it's volatile, is actually exported outside of the state and not all paid by residents, where if we shift to an income tax, for example, that is paid by only Minnesota residents.
And Ms.
Well, Mr. Chair, I think that would be a really purposeful inquiry here. I mean, for the tax committee to look at that, who pays those corporate taxes? I mean, the governor has a proposal to cut them. They are very volatile in our economic structure. I think we should know the answer to who pays those taxes and how would that tax cut affect the Minnesota economy. I'd like to know more.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schott.
Mr. Chairman, I see that Art Rolnick was a member of this group, and I'd I'd really like to hear from him about this. I think that we pay the corporate income tax. I think we pay for it in products and services. So that's one that's passed on. And yeah, I would like to hear what
I do think
his take
can,
is on this.
I do
this.
Think you can make the argument that the consumer really ultimately pays it. But where you have big multinational corporations, how that gets shifted around, I think there's probably a question about that. Senator Orban?
Mr. Chair, there's no question. We also have corporate residents in the state of Minnesota that are deeply affected by the choices we make mm-hmm. in Minnesota. I mean, there's some of both. You can say we export quite a bit of it, but how much of it and how much of it right. is actually generated by Minnesota-based companies?
Mr. Chair, one other thing. Well, actually, I'm not going to get in the middle of it.
Rubs of good, no try.
just a note that you do have large corporations, but you also have small corporations that are mom and pop and based in the community as well. So it's.
I mean, that speaks to the larger question. If we want to do something that we think helps our business climate, who are the real job creators in Minnesota? Is it the corporations, or is it all these little mom and pop businesses on main streets? And if the discussion is just about corporate tax reductions, what does it do for the larger section of Minnesota's business community that don't pay corporate taxes? And how do you help them? You often hear that the small businesses are the main job creators, but a corporate tax break, I don't know how they benefit from that. Senator Orban?
Mr. Chair, I could not agree with you more. I think that all those limited liability companies out there, all those sole proprietorships, all get taxed on an individual basis and not on a corporate tax basis. So I think it behooves us to talk about that. Who will benefit from that corporate tax cut if we entertain one? And are there better ways to stimulate the economy to address all businesses and even perhaps ways to stimulate the economy quicker? Because those corporate tax cuts, should we enact them, will take quite a bit of time to translate into real jobs in Minnesota, where maybe an individual income tax cut might actually mean quicker economic stimulus. And I hope the committee will take that up quickly.
I think that kind of speaks to the earlier comment I was making about if you cut corporate income taxes, does the money just flow to let me use the mining companies, for example, does the money just flow to U.S. Steel's bottom line or Cleveland Cliffs' bottom line, wherever their corporate office is? Or is that money actually reinvested in Minnesota where you have corporations that are not domiciled here? Anybody have the answer? Senator Senja?
No answer. I suspect it's widely dispersed, at least with the whether it's Northwest Airlines or whatever, I suspect they invest all over.
So, I think the point is, us just cutting corporate income taxes in a vacuum might not necessarily create the kind of economic activity we could expect if we maybe did something just for domiciled Minnesota companies. Maybe it's the income tax is a better place to look at.
Mr. Chair, I'm ready for the discussion. I look forward to it.
I expect we're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about it.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Langston.
There was a small business person from my district that was in my office just after the state message, and he said, I will not get any benefit out of that. And I think that's true of the vast majority of businesses in Minnesota, and I think we need to really talk about that before we get into serious decision-making, because I think it's true that the small businesses are the ones that create the most jobs, and are we going to cut taxes in half for certain people and then just leave them where they're at? May actually get property tax increases and some of that with all these things that are going on.
Senator Rest, what's your take on this discussion?
Well, I, as you know, I've been thinking about the role the corporate income tax plays in our tax system and working on a proposal. But I think that it's a bit of an urban myth that the economic vitality of a state comes from the creation of jobs from so-called small businesses, because that's where the jobs are lost also. And that there is more stability in job creation and retention in larger outfits, and I don't mean Northwest Airlines, but I mean medium-sized stable businesses than there are in the, you know, the storefront hardware stores or nail salons or the typical businesses that you would see in strip malls in suburban in the suburban metropolitan area. I think that's a valid question to ask, too. What do we mean by creation of jobs in by small businesses in terms of either, let's say, volume of business rather than sector? And is that where the most jobs are lost and the most business failures occur? And I think that raises a whole different set of questions about the impact either of property taxes or the franchise tax or the pass-through taxes. And, of course, that one of the things that to look at with the LLCs and partnerships and so on is the relationship between the top income tax rate and the rate that they're paying at that the regular corporations are paying. And that relationship is a pretty critical one in terms of what, I think at least, what type of business organization somebody chooses. And if you think you're going to have a net operating loss all the time, well, hey, that's pretty obvious where you want to go. But if you're still going to be a going concern and you're not going to fall, well, then why wouldn't you want to be a C Corp?
Well, it is true. There are different kinds of jobs. Some just circulate money within the economy.
Yeah, and others add value. I don't know value. The answer to that question.
Others add value. So our business startups that develop new product mm-hmm. line or research that leads to new product.
And Mr. Chairman, we want to encourage those.
Right.
We don't have enough jobs, innovators in Minnesota, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, Mr. Chair, on that, it'd be interesting to find out if most new businesses, which I believe is true, start out as partnerships, limited liability companies, and sole proprietorships, and when they become successful, then they move into the corporate status because they're trying to minimize their risk. Mm-hmm. And looking at that might help us as well. Where will the new money, if there's any kind of stimulus, where will it go into the economy first? Would it be at a corporate level or would it be at a more pass-through type of entity? And my thinking is it's probably the pass-through entity, but it'd be nice to know if the Department of Revenue could help us with that as well.
Representative Goodnow, you think anybody else on the commission would be interested in coming to visit with the tax committee?
Well, Ms. Chairman, I do know there's another commission that's working that was appointed by the governor just on tax issues specifically. We're heavy on the finance side, and Jenny Ng, who had former background in the tax area, was on the commission, so we did have some tax background. I had served on the tax committee before, so I think they put that in the category, even though I was a spender as well. So I'm sure if you were to ask people, there would be plenty of people who would be more than willing to talk to you about tax policy. We were not a shy group.
I'm thinking of Mr. Dorfman. I've always enjoyed some of his colorful testimony here.
And Mr. Chairman, that was actually a testament to the group that we again, if you look at the variety of the people on the group and how we came together with consensus on these recommendations, it is actually pretty good. We have a good product here, and I think everybody felt good about the product that we came up with in the end. We weren't able to get into a lot of details about the various questions that you're going to be facing coming up, though.
Senator Moore.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Goodnow, in the conversations that you all had, were there any discussions about you know, we talk a lot about job creation, which is really important, but I found it interesting about the demographics. So we have an aging population that's going to be retiring. We've been hearing from even some of our public employers that there's going to be a workforce gap. So the current population that we have may or may not even actually be able to meet the workforce needs at the where we're currently at, mm-hmm. right? And then we're also then looking to create jobs. So is there a discussion in how we manage that, or was there a discussion about strategy? Is it an issue of we have a workforce gap, but maybe is that in actual numbers, or is that in categories of jobs? And were there any discussions about a larger strategy to make sure that we actually are fitting people to the jobs that we have and appropriately fitting people to the jobs that we're creating?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moyle, we had discussions that went off on tangents. Just so you know, the commission, with the time and the tasks that we had given to us, we had to stay up at a pretty high level in order to get the work done and make these recommendations. That doesn't mean we didn't get into some of those more detailed discussions and then recognized the challenge and then went back up to the high level again. So, yes, we had discussions along those lines about how do you manage that, but it didn't find its way into findings and it didn't find its way into recommendations because that was a level of detail that we weren't able to get at with the time frame and with the task in front of us.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Chair, well, Mr. Goodnow, in those conversations, I mean, I'm interested in that conversation. And so did you identify or were you aware or was there in those internal conversations an identification of maybe other organizations or other efforts that are looking at this question that we could perhaps look to for a more detailed discussion?
Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, we did not. But I'd be happy to meet with you individually about some of the discussions that took place.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Goodnow, on page 13, I'm trying to understand something, and maybe it's just a little bit of ignorance in terms of modeling. But as you project that going out to 2033, we're going to have revenue growth at 3.9%, how do you make that kind of assumption? Just in a general, I mean, for most of us, we don't know what's going to happen next year. How are you projecting that our state is going to produce that kind of a revenue stream going on forward?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sundrum, the findings that we have in here are findings that we received from the testifiers that came in front of us. This finding came from from MMB, and it was one of the first times they've done this type of projection looking forward. That was one of our charges, look forward. What are the demographic trends, and what does that mean for us with regard to the expenditures and the revenue side? So they took current law, and they built in expected inflationary factors into that to figure out in their modeling. And you would have to have the folks from MMB come in to explain the details of how they did the modeling on this. I don't even claim to be capable of going to that level. But this was their best guess based on the current law and based on what they see the trends being in the future as to what the pressures on the expenditure sides will be and what the pressures on the revenue sides would be. Long range. So you're going to have revenues that will exceed 3.9%. You're going to have revenues that go below that.
Sure.
But on average, that would be where it was at, and it's a best guess. But best guess from people that are pretty knowledgeable about it.
Thank you.
So, Mr. Chair, members, again, anytime you're looking into the future, you know, you're taking your best shot at it based on the information you have. And we may come back 4 years from now and say these things are all off. But based on the best information we have today, these are the trends that we see going forward and the challenges we'll be facing as we move into the future.
Thank you, Mr. Goodnow. That was very helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Members, tomorrow we're meeting at 8:30. I believe it's Senate File 49. It is a bill that came to us after the conclusion of last year's session. There were two provisions in last year's tax bill that became problematic for the governor. So the leadership and the tax chairs signed a letter agreeing early in the session to take a look at those two provisions. So that's the discussion we're going to have tomorrow. The Association of Minnesota Counties is going to provide some testimony. Whether we'll get through it all tomorrow and move the bill out or not, I'm not sure. I told counties we'd give them adequate time to testify on the maintenance of effort provisions that are going to be in front of us. So
Mr. Chairman, I don't know for sure
if the bill will come out tomorrow or if it will come out next time we meet.
What's the Senate file number?
I believe it's 49.
Yeah. 49.
Okay. Senator Pogler, anything further to add? Committee's adjourned till 8:30 tomorrow morning.